or a team, or recognize these examples in the people around you. Remember, you can apply the meaning behind this analogy to any situation you have in your life. Level 1. The Authentic Self. Imagine that you like soccer, and you can go to a game at any stadium in the world. It could be a magnificent stadium or a dirt-filled field. The players could be great or mediocre. You are not rooting for or against a side. It doesn't matter who is playing. As soon as you see a game, you sit, watch, and enjoy it for those 90 minutes. You simply enjoy watching the game for what it is. The players could even be kicking around a tin can, and you still enjoy the ups and downs of the sport. The moment the referee blows the whistle that ends the game, win or lose, you leave the game behind. You walk out of the stadium and continue on with your life. At this level, you can enjoy a moment in time without any real attachment. You invested just enough of yourself to choose to attend or watch the game. This is you in total control of knowledge. You experienced the purest form of joy, stemming from your pure desire to experience life without conditions. Level 2. Preference. This time you attend a game, again at any stadium in the world, with any teams playing, but now you root for one of the teams. You've realized that if you invest a little more of yourself by identifying a preference, the emotional roller coaster makes the game more exciting. You decide which team to root for based on just about anything, from the color of the uniforms to the names of the players. Perhaps you simply pick the home team. You spend the game rooting for one team but not necessarily against the other. Still, in the end, you walk out of the stadium and leave it all behind. At this level, you've invested a small piece of yourself in the game. You formed an attachment to something, however arbitrary, and based your decisions and actions on that attachment. You have engaged in a preference for a team. You created a story of victory or defeat that shaped the experience, but the story had nothing to do with you personally, because the story was about the team. You engaged with the event and the people around you, but at the end of the game, you simply say, "That was fun," and let go of the attachment. This ability to attach and detach easily allows you to invest an emotional side of yourself that will enjoy the ups and downs of a great game. Life is happening, and you are able to share it with those around you, regardless of how they see themselves. Level 3. Identity. This time, you are a committed fan of a particular team. Their colors strike an emotional chord inside of you. When the referee blows the whistle, the result of the game affects you on an emotional level. This is your favorite team. You can still go to any stadium or field in the world, but nothing compares to seeing this team play. Your team, winning or losing, partially defines your character beyond the 90 minutes of the game. You feel elated when your team wins. When your team loses, you feel disappointed. But still, your team's performance is not a condition of your own self-acceptance. And if your team loses, you're able to accept the defeat as you congratulate the other side. You accept the victories and disappointments as part of the emotional roller coaster that makes life interesting, but your self-worth is not based on these outcomes. If you meet a fan of the opposing team, you see not only a fan of soccer, but also a fellow human being with whom you are willing to share a beer. You can sit together and discuss soccer, and you can talk about how great you think your team is. You might even admit that you think their team is great as well. Your feelings and opinions surrounding your team are not a condition by which you relate to others or to yourself. At this level, your attachment to your team begins to impact your personal life outside the stadium gates as you relate to the world as a fan. The separation isn't quite as clear as it was at first. At level 3, this culture, this team, has become a small part of your identity. When the event or moment passes, it still forms who you think you are. You take the knowledge with you and begin to shape parts of your life around this team, bringing it to other environments that have nothing to do with it. For example, if your team loses, you might have a bad day at work, argue with someone about what or who is responsible for the team losing, or feel sad despite the good things going on around you. No matter what the effect is, you've let an attachment change your persona. Your attachment bleeds into a world that has nothing to do with it. Level 4. Internalization. Staying with our sports analogy at level 4, your association with your favorite team has now become an intrinsic part of your identity. The story of victory and defeat is now about you. Your team's performance affects your self-worth. When reading the stats, you admonish players for making us look bad. If the opponent team wins, you get angry that they beat you. You feel disconsolate when your team loses and may even create excuses for the defeat. Of course, you would never sit down with one of their fans in a pub for a friendly chat. You might even find yourself consumed with finding out more information about the players. On the other hand, each and every word of praise your team earns feels as though it is directed at you. Not only have you brought the game home, you have completely incorporated it into your persona, shaping your identity by your belief of what it means to be a real fan. Although the team, the piece of knowledge in this story, has nothing to do with you in reality, your self-importance correlates with your attachment. Your life and your attachment are so blurred that everything starts to revolve around this team. Your fellow fans had better behave, too, because they all represent these colors, and these colors mean something. They have value in your life. They had better fit what it means to be a real fan. Otherwise, they shouldn't call themselves one. You find yourself debating how much better your team is outside the context of the game. You believe that anyone who doesn't agree with you is wrong. This is the point where the belief has moved from an identity to internalization. When dealing with the fans of opposing teams, you will argue and shout, but it will stop short of fisticuffs. You can still limit your defense to just arguing. While you may have some friends who are not soccer fans, you much prefer the company of those who think like you. As your attachment grows, you might make your loyalty to this team a condition by which you allow others to be in a relationship with you, including yourself. In other words, you have internalized your attachment to such an extent that it has become a condition of self-acceptance. Thus, you begin to impose this image onto the people you love, as well as the people you interact with in your everyday life. Level 5. Fanaticism. At this level, you worship your team. Your blood bleeds their colors. If you see an opposing team's fan, they are automatically your enemy, because this shield must be defended. This is your land, and others must be subjugated so that they too can see that your team is the real team. Others are just frauds. What happens on the field says everything about you. Winning championships makes you a better person, and there is always a conspiracy theory that allows you to never accept a loss as legitimate. There is no longer a separation between you and your attachment of any kind. You are committed to your team through and through, a fan 365 days a year. Your family is going to wear the jersey, and they better be fans of your team. If any of your kids become a fan of an opposing team, you will disinherit them. Out! At level 5, your family can easily be torn apart and destroyed if any one of you turns your back on the team. Relationships mean nothing to you unless they are a believer in your team. Every action you take, every decision you make, is within the rules that you think make a great fan. Of course, you can't see anything from the point of view of someone who does not share your love of your team. If you did, you would be considered a traitor by your own standards. At levels 3 and 4, you may still have friends who do not like soccer, but at level 5, you don't waste your time with people who don't love this sport. They do not know better. You choose not to have them in your life, and you are willing to fight for what you believe in. Your belief becomes more important than the experience. As your attachment grows, it can reach a culminating point where respect is lost even for humanity. In your eyes, a true fan is willing to die and kill for his team. It doesn't even matter if the referee blows the whistle to start or end the game. It doesn't even matter if they play soccer. The symbol and the colors are more important than your own life or anyone else's life. Whenever we believe something without question, we are at risk for attachment at this most extreme level, and it can exist in the most unlikely places. If you are having difficulty relating to the sports analogy at this level of attachment, let me conclude with two real-life examples. At the end of one soccer season in Europe, a big-name club was relegated into the second division, a lesser division. After witnessing that team's final loss, a fan went home and hung himself. For him, life was no longer worth living if his team wasn't in the Premier League. In another instance, a bus driver was a fan of a team that lost the Champions League final. He was so upset by this that he drove his bus into a group of people wearing the winning team's jersey. Four people died for wearing the wrong colors. This man's attachment to his team was so great, he killed for it. Fortunately, murder and suicide due to a favorite team's loss are rare occurrences. But when we turn to topics such as religion, politics, or our ideas about money, sex, and power, the examples of attachment at this level are numerous. Turn on any news station, and it's easy to see. It's important to realize that when we or anyone else become attached to a set of beliefs at this level, it is easy not to see the humanity of an individual, since we can only see the personalization of an idea that we stand against. At level one, you can go to any church, synagogue, temple, mosque, or drum circle, and you will find and feel the love and grace of God. At level five, God just happens to be the focus of devotion that the religion is centered on. In other words, the religion is more important than God. Imagine spirituality, homeopathic remedies, or veganism. Apply the levels to race or ethnicity or sexual orientation. Apply it to love. The five levels of attachment can be applied to any form of information, and suddenly the consequences become far less trivial. While soccer is a good introduction to the five levels of attachment because it breaks down the concept into fairly understandable parts, the purpose is for you to see how the levels play out in your own life. As I explain the levels in detail in the ensuing chapters, you will begin to think about how attached you are to your various beliefs. You will learn how to assess what level you are on for every belief that you have, not as a basis for judgment, but to perceive a deeper understanding of self. The goal is to shift your perspective and see the potential that is present beyond your beliefs, and notice how your understanding of love and respect changes as your attachments' hold on you diminish. Lastly, as we move through these next chapters, keep in mind my grandmother's question: is knowledge controlling you, or are you controlling knowledge? Chapter 5. Level 1. The Authentic Self. Is knowledge controlling you, or are you controlling knowledge? I am a living being regardless of my knowledge, which exists only because I exist. The first level of attachment represents the authentic self, the living being that is the full potential of life. It describes the force that not only animates the body but also gives life to our mind and our soul. The authentic self is always present, and it is only our attachments that keep us from remembering who we really are. From this place, our name is an empty symbol whose definition or meaning is determined by our agreement. The action of making that agreement is the first expression of me. When we were born, our parents lifted us up and held us in their arms. They envisioned endless possibilities for us in their love for us. They saw the unlimited potential of our authentic self, the life force that could take any action in any direction that would lead to those possibilities. But as we grew up, those possibilities diminished as our vision of what we were able to do and be became narrowed by our attachments until we believed we had little choice in life. The truth is that we narrowed our possibilities by our own will. Yes, it is true that the dream of the planet can narrow our possibilities if we wish to play along with its rules, but the agreements we make with ourselves matter most when it comes to being able to manifest our intent. This is because a simple no in our own mind can stop us from taking any form of action. That is how powerful our agreements are. We never stopped being the potential that our parents envisioned for us when we were babies. The only difference is that as adults we now have control of not just our body, but also our mind. We require no knowledge to be our authentic self, and our awareness of this is what allows us to use knowledge as we engage the world, using our body through our mind as the vehicle that allows us to take action in life. It is a beautiful symbiotic relationship of action-reaction through which we are able to experience a connection, a communion between ourselves and all of creation. In all of our traditions, we hear the lessons of the wise men and women who teach us the beauty of life and how to let go of illusions, reminding us of our true essence. This is a moment of harmony with everything and the energy of life that courses through us. Every world religion and spiritual tradition has a name for the moment when we become aware that nothing but harmony exists. In the Toltec tradition, we would call this being in constant communion with our Creator. The only thing that separates us from one another is our point of perception. Together we make a whole. Engagement is the action of interacting with the focal point of our attention. As we engage life, we naturally go up and down the levels of our attachments like a flower continuously opening and closing as days pass by. Sometimes we let go of our awareness as we increase our attachment to a focal point. Other times we remember our authenticity as we let go of the attachment. But regardless of our degree of attachment, we are always our authentic selves. We just simply forget that as we move up the levels of attachment. With the practice of awareness, we develop a discipline, a strengthening of our will that allows us to remain in a state of harmony longer, if we choose to. Many religious and spiritual traditions in the world have created a discipline that fosters this harmony, such as prayer, meditation, yoga, chanting, and dancing, among many others. This knowledge is an instrument of transformation, and experiencing it is the manifestation of the authentic self. I used to think that the world's greatest masters of every tradition were the best examples of the authentic self. But now I realize that everyone I know and see is a personification of the authentic self. We are all creating, producing, learning, engaging, and loving life. We are all the personification of life. We are always the authentic self. We simply make the choice to see it in ourselves and others. There is a moment when the authentic self becomes no longer an abstract term, but an experience. I believe we all experience such a moment. It could be during meditation, while painting or dancing, working or working out, lecturing or talking, making love, eating, or playing. It's the moment when judgment stops and pure harmony takes over. For me, I have crossed that threshold from concept to experience while jogging, usually around the 1 mile marker. This is when I am no longer thinking about my route, pace, or even the pain in my legs. This is a moment when everything goes calm, and all I can feel is my breath, the stride, and the environment. My mind suddenly shuts off and I am completely in the moment, and I know exactly what I am doing without the need for thought. From this place, even the term authentic self disappears, along with the rest of my thoughts. I am simply alive with the complete freedom to love myself and everybody as I choose. I have no need to distort the information I perceive, because my perception of life is unencumbered by any attachments. The authentic self is the harmony of mind, body, and soul as the expression of life. To tell the story of the authentic self is to tell the story of life, regardless of where humanity may be in the form of an individual's awareness. When we reside at this level, we have the freedom to choose how we want to engage the dream of the planet. The awareness that we are the living being that gives life to our beliefs, to our knowledge, lets us choose with complete freedom where we want to place our intent and create, for as long as we choose to engage it by our agreement. Our will is set with the full awareness of our intent. Knowledge is alive in our minds precisely because we are alive, and that knowledge is the tool by which we can communicate with the rest of the world. In this state of harmony, we have the potential to love unconditionally, because we have no conditions for self-acceptance, just a willingness to engage love with a respect for self and others. If someone were to say or do something insulting when we are residing in level one, the authentic self, it wouldn't bother us. Their words and actions would fall off us like loose garments, as there is nothing in us for them to stick to. Because our love is not based on a behavior that we agree with or find acceptable, we love them even through such instances. From here, every possibility is available to us. We have the freedom to evolve as life evolves and to engage the people we love without the need to domesticate them to our point of view. Chapter 6. Level 2. Preference. Is knowledge controlling you, or are you controlling knowledge? I use knowledge as the tool by which I engage my preferences in life. At the second level of attachment, we still move with the awareness of the authentic self. We recognize our ability to attach ourselves to something as we engage in the present moment. But we are also able to let go of the attachment when the moment has passed. We see ourselves as a reflection of life in the dream of the planet, and we attach and detach ourselves with ease, simply by recognizing and letting go of that reflection. Here's an example. Do you remember playing make-believe as a kid? I recall that before beginning the game, we'd all discuss the roles we'd be playing. Then we would each draw from our knowledge of what was needed to create a mask that resembled us in that role, so that we could play. Next, we would take on the persona of that role. Our faces would change as soon as we started playing, and our behavior would be adapted to fit the battlefield, the hair salon, the dinner table, the hospital, or even a day in the office. What made these games so much fun is that we used our imaginations and played our parts to create a fantasy world in which we could all engage each other in different scenarios, as if we were playing in a dream with others while we were awake. As much fun as it was to engage in these games with our friends and family, when the game was over, we took off the mask that was created by our knowledge and went back to being ourselves. At level two, we have the awareness that knowledge is a tool that provides us with the information we need to make choices about where we wish to place our attention and take action. But at this level, we don't distort that information we perceive, and we are using it to engage only in this moment. We can choose to adapt in accordance with the present life situation without losing the awareness of our authentic self, without the need to project a false image of self. In the Toltec tradition, this is called controlled folly. The awareness and honoring of self as we engage the people around us who project an image or mask onto us. Our awareness allows us to see the temptation to become attached to that projected mask, but we maintain clarity. At this level of attachment, we don't forget we are playing a game, which makes it easier for us to detach once the game is over. This awareness allows us to live without needing to distort knowledge to fit our individual points of view, our attachments, and thus, knowledge at this stage is still our ally. It is not corrupted by our sense of self-importance or any form of conditional love. Our relationship with knowledge allows us to engage life as it is. We are able to make choices with our reason as we perceive the difference between truth and distortion. And knowledge is a clean and perfect reflection of life. From the Toltec standpoint, this is the clean mirror. We see every situation as it is, unclouded by smoke. We have the awareness that knowledge is the perfect reflection of life, and we are life. We have the awareness that the act of engaging in life is an act of love, and because we are choosing the direction in which we want to go and how we want to live, this is the act of unconditional love for ourselves. By approaching our lives as a work of art based on our own self-love, this allows us to unconditionally love the people in our lives for who they are, without needing to domesticate them to see our point of view. Respect for the manifestation of our loved ones' own individual dreams, whether or not we agree with their choices, is always present at this level of attachment. Our love for self allows us to give love to the community. After all, we cannot give or share what we don't have. Every thought and idea that forms our belief system has power only through our agreement in the form of yes or no. And it is our preference of how we want to engage the dream of the planet and life. The word Toltec means artist in English, and life is the canvas for a Toltec's art. I am aware that knowledge is an instrument by which I am able to interact with the world, and my yeses and nos are the chisels or paintbrushes by which I create. I engage in the Toltec tradition by choice, fully aware that the name Toltec refers to an action or agreement belonging to a philosophy. Not calling myself a Toltec wouldn't lessen my agreement or the lessons I learn from this oral tradition. This means my agreement is not subjugated to an identity. My knowledge is not in the form of a mask that gives meaning to my definition of self. I am free to choose to agree, disagree, scrutinize, and engage with the Toltec philosophy, or any other, as much as I want. I am free to relate and engage in relationships with people who have a preference for another tradition or philosophy. I can change my mind when I no longer fully agree, or I may agree with it my whole life. That is true with every belief I have. I engage it for as long as I want to engage it, knowing full well that I am a living being with the full potential to experience life with or without that agreement. This is what gives power to my agreements. I make them because I want to. This is my art, my agreement, to allow myself to experience life in its ever-changing truth, with love. Think about an individual who chooses to eat healthfully, and through her search, she has chosen as her preference to follow a vegan diet, a diet that includes no animal products. She uses this knowledge to inform her choices when she eats, but she does not use the knowledge to identify herself as vegan, nor does she use the knowledge to domesticate herself or others by it. If she chooses to have ice cream, she can do so without self-judgment and then re-engage the vegan diet afterward if she so chooses. She uses knowledge to engage her preference with regard to her nutrition without ever losing her awareness of self. Now substitute the example of a vegan diet with a lifestyle choice of your own. Do you engage in this choice with preference, or is it a rigid framework by which you judge your self-worth? If the latter, you know you are attached at a level beyond preference. Our attention gives direction to the bridge that allows us to express and share with one another our knowledge of life, the agreements by which we construct our relationships, as well as express our preferences. With awareness, knowledge remains the bridge of communication between us, a clean foundation as we construct the dream of us. In our shared dream, it is my preference to be in this relationship at this moment and to love everyone, as well as myself, unconditionally. Chapter 7. Level 3. Identity. Is knowledge controlling you, or are you controlling knowledge? I identify myself with my knowledge, although I use it to see and understand the world. We have a need to name, describe, and understand the things we engage with in life. Knowledge allows us to understand the world and the universe, but when it comes to understanding ourselves, our identity is a symbol that can be wrapped up in an expression of our knowledge. From the stance of knowledge, identity is the grounding sense of self that allows us to have our place in the dream of the planet. It gives us a point of reference by which we identify and engage with one another. But this identity is a mask that blurs our awareness of the authentic self. An attachment at this level occurs when we identify ourselves with our knowledge. In the Toltec tradition, the mirror is still a clean reflection at the identity level, but it is here that we begin to lose the awareness of the line that separates life and the reflection in the mirror. This is where we begin to believe that the reflection is the truth. The main condition for acceptance in the dream of the planet is that our identity is recognized in a world of 7 billion souls. Although we do not domesticate ourselves forming this identity, domestication occurs in level 4, internalization. By adopting it, we are hoping to be understood by our community, and thus ourselves. In wanting to be heard by the dream of the planet, our voice takes on an identity to express itself. Or so we think. When we use knowledge to construct the dream of us, or the dream of the planet, our identity is the mask by which the dream of the planet will understand us. When speaking mind to mind, knowledge recognizes knowledge, so we become attached to the mask of our identity. At this level, we forget that the mask of our identity is an empty symbol. Just like a word whose definition is subject to an agreement set by us and the use of knowledge in the dream of the planet. Just as language can change over time, so too can our identity mask. As we increase our attachment to our identity, knowledge and consensus become very important to us, to the point where they give us meaning in life. So we construct the mask of our identity by becoming the embodiment of our acquired knowledge in the form of our passion. This is a mask based on our preferences in life. Everyone we meet has a name and an identity with a meaning to go along with that name. Identity can be based on things like the color of our skin, the nationality of our family, the religion we practice, the political party that best reflects our beliefs, the sports team that allows us the excitement of winning and losing, the work we engage in every day, and the activities we love to participate in. Our name and identity give us a purpose and a sense of belonging. For example, think of the people you know and the identities either they have assumed or you have ascribed to them. Patty the teacher, Scott the fireman, Joe the next-door neighbor, Jose the brother. What identities have you adopted for yourself? How do you portray those identities in the world? When you are at level 3, you confuse these identities with who you really are. As adults, we still have the ability to play make-believe like we did when we were children. That is, we still have the ability to create a mask based on our knowledge of how to engage one another in a particular setting. But as adults, the mask becomes a way to adapt socially and relate to a group with whom we are interacting, and we have forgotten that it's just a mask. We think the mask is us. To return to a sports metaphor, consider how non-football fans can get so involved in Super Bowl parties. Knowing that it's fun and exciting to invest something of oneself in the game, non-football fans will likely choose a side to root for, eagerly climbing aboard the emotional roller coaster of the game. But when the game is over, whether or not the favored team has won, a person at the level of preference, level 2, will be able to walk away from the game detached from the moment. Now contrast that with the fans who may be out of sorts for days if their team loses, or incredibly jubilant if their team is victorious. Having forgotten to remove the mask, they are attached at level 3. At the identity level, the authentic self has the mask of the attachment in the form of identity. This level of attachment can feel great when your team wins or when things are going your way. But as life shows us, what goes up must come down. And no one wins all the time. That is why suffering inevitably occurs when you are attached at this level. We won't always be able to get what we want, but instead of having a preference and moving on if things don't go our way, at this level we have become attached. Let's continue with the example of the vegan woman. At this level, she now calls herself a vegan, the symbol of her preference, even when she is not engaging in a meal. Her identity as a vegan gives her a purpose and a place in her community, and when she makes choices, her identity as a vegan is reflected. If she were to have ice cream, she may feel disappointed in her choice, but after a short time she will forgive herself and move on. She does not place unreasonable conditions on herself for self-acceptance based on her identity, nor do her friends and family need to be vegan in order to be in her life. She still has respect for others' manifestations of their personal dreams, just as she has respect for her own manifestation. These are the hallmarks of level 3. We have donned the mask of identity and forgotten it is a mask. This forgetting of who we really are, the authentic self, leads to some suffering, but generally not an inordinate amount. In the next level, internalization, our attachment to knowledge becomes more pronounced, domestication occurs, and we cause suffering for ourselves and those around us. Chapter 8. Level 4. Internalization. Is knowledge controlling you, or are you controlling knowledge? My identity, in the form of my knowledge, gives me the rules and guidelines by which I live my life. The fourth level of attachment, internalization, describes a degree of attachment to knowledge where our identity becomes the model by which we accept ourselves. This is domestication through attachment. At this level, our narrators have begun to set the conditions by which we domesticate our identity. They measure our acceptance and rejection of ourselves and others based on the beliefs we use to construct the mask of our identity. We will distort the information we receive to reinforce the conditions of what we expect from life. The narrators also serve our need to validate who we are in our personal dream, as well as the face we present to the dream of the planet. Our knowledge is corrupted. It is no longer a clean reflection, but a smoky mirror. Our sense of self is the personification of our beliefs, and our will is subjugated by the need to fit in with the dream. Thus, our mask may not necessarily be in the form of our passion, but we will wear whatever mask we think we need to be accepted. At this level of attachment, our focus is on internalizing an idealized version of our identity, and we may project a false image of self to secure our acceptance. This is the direct result of our domestication through conditional love. Acceptance is the reward of domestication, while rejection is the punishment. Although these conditions for acceptance and rejection may not be as rigid as the next level of attachment, they are learned and ingrained through the constant interaction we have with others. We use these conditions as guideposts for accepting and rejecting other people, but also, and especially, ourselves. The attachment is to the mechanism of acceptance and rejection itself, which corrupts knowledge to fit our sense of self and influences how we relate with life. At this point, we've lost our respect for self and others, and conditional love is all we know. One day, I had just gotten back from being in the park in Teotihuacan, Mexico, and decided to go to my hotel room to rest for a couple of hours. I turned the television on to a program in which two young women were combing a beach in Mexico looking for the best and worst fashions on the beach. They were both dressed stylishly, and as they walked the beach with confidence, they critiqued and ridiculed whomever they judged to be poorly dressed. The camera would then zoom in on unflattering shots of the unsuspecting beachgoers. In the segment, it seemed like everyone received a failing grade. The two hosts were apparently the only well-dressed people on the beach. Toward the end of the segment, however, they ran into someone they deemed to be even better dressed than they were. One of the hosts walked up to the fashionable lady, showered her with praise, and asked her to share her fashion wisdom. The change in the host's demeanor was incredible. They went from being unmerciful judges to subjugated followers. As I watched the show, I couldn't help but think back to my teenage years, where walking down the hall was very much like this television show. I had been both the recipient of criticism and the critic myself, working on an image where adulation was the expression of acceptance. I remember feeling uncomfortable when I was the focus for not meeting the standards of one group, and I remember how righteous I felt being the critic in the group I identified with. This kind of behavior isn't limited to appearances or trends. It occurs in spiritual circles, in the workplace, and in many other facets of life. The mechanism of our conditional love, the judge and the victim, has been mastered by many individuals. I have seen some people turn the identity of a Toltec into a catalyst for their own domestication by turning the agreements for pursuit of personal freedom into conditions of acceptance, even rejecting others who engage in traditions that are different from ours. So it doesn't matter what the belief is, attachment at this level will corrupt it. To continue with our dietary example, let's say the person who calls herself a vegan now uses her identity as the catalyst for her conditional love. In order to be worthy of her own love, she must be a strict vegan and not stray, lest she feel the wrath of her self-judgment. She surrounds herself with other vegans who will confirm the worthiness of being a vegan by accepting and judging themselves and others. She limits the people in her life who are not vegan and will try to domesticate the people she loves to change their diet, feeling pity for them for not being awake to her point of view. Thus, she is in constant conflict with points of view that do not side with her own. She is still eating a healthy diet, but she is imposing onto herself and others the knowledge that goes along with her preference in life. Her mask of identity still reflects a passion of her authentic self, but the smoke has created a distorted image of that truth as domestication has set in. Only unhappiness stems from the judge and victim mentality. To live up to these conditions and be accepted, we hide who we really are not only from others but also from ourselves. We are completely confused, believing that the mask we have created is who we are. We create what we believe is an acceptable image for conditional love, regardless of our passion and preference in life, and project that image solely for the purpose of acceptance. The image of a luchador, a Mexican professional wrestler, comes to mind, always fighting for fame and fortune. While he is keeping his enemies from taking his mask off and exposing his true identity, he is also trying to take off his opponent's mask so that his shines brighter with glory. Attachment at this level results in disharmony between mind, body, and soul, and this is reflected in all of one's relationships. The only glimpses of peace come through individual victories, and these moments are far from permanent. This is the version of the dream of the planet that appears to be in constant conflict. Chapter 9, Level 5, Fanaticism. Is knowledge controlling you, or are you controlling knowledge? My knowledge controls my every action. Level 5, Fanaticism, describes a rigid attachment to knowledge with an excessive intolerance of opposing views. It is driven by a need to believe in something 100%, even though that something's meaning is dependent upon the agreement of others. Anything that contradicts or puts into question the sustainability of the belief is a direct threat, and a fanatic will defend the belief at any cost. Prejudice, intolerance, and violence are the instruments by which the belief is imposed onto the dream of the planet. Regardless of how it can appear, the driving force behind fanaticism is not hate or anger, but rather an extreme form of conditional love for self and others. This is how any beautiful belief in the world can become lost in corruption, as knowledge controls a person's will for the sake of its own existence. With fanaticism, a person's beliefs have fully and completely domesticated them, and knowledge becomes rigid and controlling. It has a tight grip on our will. Attachment at this degree requires us to try and domesticate everyone around us, and we become tyrants. There is no freedom in tyranny. In the Toltec tradition, the smoke does not let us see that there even is a mirror. The smoke is all we see. For example, to illustrate this level on a small but far-reaching scale, I turn again to our young vegan woman who is now a mother. She domesticates her son to fall in line with the family tradition of being vegan, in an effort to give him the identity that she is convinced is the only correct one, the identity she has adopted for herself. Please keep in mind that my objective here is not to judge veganism or make any of these examples a catalyst for debate. I only want to present a mirror. Imagine a dinner at this family's home. The young mother is making a meal in the kitchen while her husband and son sit at the dining room table. "What would you like to eat?" asks the mother. "Carne asada," replies the boy. "We don't eat carne asada in this house," she says in a serious tone. The boy begins to protest and pleads with his father to support him. The father, who has adopted the mother's belief system, responds by asking the son to listen to his mother. The child reiterates his plea for carne asada, as the mother responds that the rest of the family only likes healthy vegan meals. "We are vegans," says the mother. "No, I am not a vegan," says the boy. "Okay, then you are going to have to find a new place to live," says the mother. The mother's attachment to this ideal has led to a condition for the child, that to be a member of the family, he must be a vegan too. This is domestication, as the reward for the child to eat a vegan meal is his acceptance as a member of the family. If he does not, he will be rejected by his family. Under level 4, internalization, there is still space for the boy to say no, with the possibility that the mother will not follow through with her condition. But when the attachment becomes fanatical, the result is unrelenting conflict and domestication, and any contrary response leads to absolute rejection. Imagine this situation in a family where the attachment is between a father and daughter about differing political beliefs, or a brother who is fanatical about the healing properties of homeopathic remedies, and a sister who is fanatical about the healing properties of traditional medicine. This is an unrelenting war, where passion is replaced by obsession, an obsession to live up to the conditions of the mask of our identity. And whoever wins reinforces their attachment as the righteous beacon of knowledge that will awaken everybody to their truth. This type of interaction within families is not uncommon, and could also be applied to religious beliefs, social status, and so on. This is a case where one feels they must impose their beliefs upon other members of the family, and will not cease until they are successful at subjugating the other's will, or until a loss of the relationship occurs. This is the real consequence of fanaticism, a wedge between people who would really love one another if it weren't for this argument. I have seen people become fanatical about the Toltec tradition as well, where the concepts and lessons of personal freedom and the agreements and teachings aren't as important as the need to impose the philosophy on themselves and others as the only truth. "I only want to be around people who are enlightened by the Toltec philosophy," is a comment I have heard on occasion. I have also heard criticism for not being Toltec enough. It doesn't matter what the belief system is. If someone is fanatical, they have let their happiness and acceptance of others be dependent on adherence to that belief system. This form of unrelenting conflict can take a person to the point where an idea or belief is more important than their own life, let alone the lives of others. Stories of honor killings throughout the world, regardless of religion or social status, embody an extreme form of conditional love within a family. From a point of view where a person's behavior is forced upon them under conditions of life and death, the dream of the planet can be seen as a nightmare. Death in the name of love. When it is possible to be so attached to a way of life that the lives of our own family members are considered less important than upholding family values, then imagine what the extreme form of this level of attachment is capable of when it comes to perfect strangers. The most obvious examples of fanaticism can be found in news reports that describe killings in the name of some cause, belief, or way of life, where one's love for their fellow man is entirely conditional upon the other's willingness to do or be exactly what is expected and acceptable within that belief system. The narrator speaks so loudly in these cases that they drown out the authentic self completely, and relentlessly impose conditional love to such an extreme that death is a means to the end. Attachment at this level doesn't present itself only in the form of death, but where the violence of torture, rape, or any desecration of another being, be it man, woman, child, or animal, becomes a viable choice and action. Fanaticism is the complete loss of respect for another living being when we no longer see an individual as a living being, and instead only an idea or a number. Unfortunately, there are many stories that illustrate this in the news and sensationalist media, but know that the individuals who take such actions all suffer from a form of illusion in which they believe they are justified in taking such actions. Fanatics also impose unrealistic standards on themselves, trying to fit a mold at the risk of their own life. This is the case with anorexia or bulimia, where a person is so attached to achieving a certain ideal that they can no longer see the truth of who they are, even when they see themselves in the mirror. The image of oneself can become so distorted that one's own perception of one's humanity is lost. There is no awareness that a line has been crossed, only an illusion remains. Death comes without the awareness of having